Thanks very much, everyone, for coming. Thank you, Lauren, for the kind invitation. So today it's my great pleasure to provide like a introductory lecture to generative modeling. So this topic is really fascinating, but before getting diving deeper into the topic, I would like first just to give you a brief review of what we learned so far in the course. So with Lauren, you have learned in the first part of this course the topic of supervised learning, where you have a data set made of data points and labels, and there are different ways you can map or learn this data distribution or this data set, either using linear regression, feed-forward neural networks, or convolutional neural networks, in addition to other more advanced architectures that we haven't learned yet. And on top of unsupervised learning, there's also the possibility of learning features about data sets that don't have labels. So for instance, we can have like a linear embedding of the data using principal component analysis, or a nonlinear embedding using TSNE. And in this lecture, we're gonna learn about a new way of doing unsupervised learning using generative modeling. Okay. So as you have also learned in a previous lecture by Lauren, the goal of generative modeling is, given some data set made of some data points that don't have labels, which that's sampled from some data distribution that we don't know a priori. So this data distribution is very hard to get because for instance, if you're working with pictures, the space of possibility is very large. So to get this exactly, it's very hard. So a priori, we have some data distribution sampled from some unknown distribution, and the goal is through some generative model, which has some distribution described by some parameters lambda, we do some sort of training. And then at the end, we hope that the distribution of the generative model is approximating the data distribution that we don't know a priori. And the way we do this is by mapping the learning problem of this distribution to an optimization problem. And we do this through this negative log likelihood that we learned about in the previous lecture, where we're summing over the negative average of the log probabilities of the data points in our data set. And you've seen that, well, this is equivalent to, so minimizing the negative log likelihood is exactly the same as maximizing the likelihood, which is the product of all the probabilities in the training data set. Okay? And you've seen also that we do this for the sake of numerical convenience. Well, if you do the products of these probabilities, you'll get a very small number, and it's very hard to do to maximize this, like to do like differentiate, to do like this differentiation for a small number. So instead, we do this on the logarithm. And this also another reason why we use a negative log likelihood is because it's related to the KL divergence between the data distribution and our model probability distribution. And you've seen that this is a constant which is related to the entropy of the data plus the negative log likelihood. Okay, so the KL is kind of like seeing how close these probability distributions, and the negative log likelihood is a proxy to access the KL divergence. Okay, so far so good. Is everything clear at this point? Okay, so let's now get started with the topic. So I would like first ask you a question, which is like, why we do generative modeling? Why do you think it's very helpful to do generative modeling in general? Does anyone have an idea? Yeah.
If we can generate synthetic data for something, it could be a lot cheaper than just like running more like experiments.
Cool. Yeah. So you mean here, like you want to send, like get some new data points. Right, that's a good point. So let's write that. So generate data points with a cheaper cost, right? Hopefully, yeah, with a cheaper cost. Right, does anyone have an idea of another use of generative modeling?
Might not understand like the underlying model that describes our system, so we can try to fit some parameters to describe it with like our generated model.
Right, so you want to find like a simple description of the properties of the data, right? So find a simple, hopefully simple, yeah, formulation, formula for B data. Great. Does anyone have another motivation for?
Question.
Yeah.
Is P of lambda, does it like, we know the functional form of P in terms of lambda, or?
That's a very.
And you just want to train lambda parameters? Or?
Right, so lambdas are the parameters that we train inside this black box here. So we're going to see, like in the lecture, different ways we can express this P lambda. So this is a good point. So it's something.
In some sense, we already know a little about our model.
So yeah, so we, of course, so we have to guess, have to do some first guess about the model, but the P data, that's something we don't know. So that's something we have to figure out through the optimization. Sounds good? Okay. Does anyone have another motivation? Okay, so let me give you some few other motivations. So the other point that we can, the other thing, interesting thing we can do with generative models is that we, for some unknown probability of the data, we can actually like do inference on the probability of some data points which does not belong to the training data. So we can do maybe some approximation of this probability, and this is very useful, for instance, in the case of physics, where you want to like do some computation of observables, where you need these kind of probabilities. So this is very helpful. And something else that could help is to fill in gaps in the data. So for instance, this also goes into this point, but for instance, you could imagine a picture and you punch a hole in the picture, and you could maybe try to use a generative model to complete the picture. So this maybe could be a possibility, fill gaps and data. Okay. And I also want to show you some slides just to further motivate why generative modeling is a fascinating topic. So can I have the screen down, please?
What is the difference between the second and third?
This one?
Second and third.
Second and third.
You're trying to
right, yeah. So this could be like the ultimate goal for physicists. We want to find a simple formula, but of course this might not be always practical because you can find a you might have a complicated model. So instead, like we can use maybe a complicated model to do some approximation of P data.
Okay.
Yeah. That's a good point. Yeah. That's cool. So one of the interesting applications of generative modeling is to generate faces. So this interesting application like allows you to generate faces that do not exist. So you can, if you want, you can go to this website and check out by yourself. And another application by...
It's biased to good-looking people.
Sorry?
I guess it's biased to good-looking people.
Yeah, maybe that's like also something you can search as well, like the bias in the training data. So what you feed in is what you get as well. So this another interesting application is by OpenAI called DALL-E, where what you can do is just write something, like you write like a description of the picture you want, and then you get a sketch of it. So for instance, I tried a 3D realistic render of an astronaut walking on Mars, and I was amazed that it got something really good. Another example is like this sketch, like you have a pencil and color drawing of a bright city with flying cars, as you can see. So it can do these amazing things as well. Another thing that generative models can do is that they can even generate music. So this company called AVA, or Artificial Intelligence Virtual Artists, like can do that. So I just want you to hear a sample of that, just so they can appreciate how powerful they can be.
Thank you.
Yeah, so it looks very cool and it's very, like, very, everything is coherent.
What is the input here? What do you tell?
So you just feed in, like, symphonies of maybe, like, old, some old fish symphonies, and they try to get some new samples out of that. I'm not sure about how exactly to do that, but that's the feeling I have. Right? Yeah, so another, the famous example that you all know is, like, this one. So I tried just to try how, like, how ChatGPT would explain genetic modeling to a 5 year old kid. It just, I was amazed by the answer that it gave. So it's, like, it's pretty cool because it tries to find some analogies that a 5 year old kid, so like a toy, you have friends, and you make a new toy, so it's pretty cool. And based on this analogy, so you imagine the new toy is a computer, and the computer is using its imagination to make something new. So it's pretty cool. So this, I hope this would help you to just appreciate how powerful these models can be. And these are not only used in these, like, applications, but they can also be used in science. For instance, in cosmology, they can use to generate, like, convergence maps that are used in cosmology for detecting the distribution of dark matter and some sort of this stuff. And it's also used in many quantum antibody physics for quantum state tomography. So for instance, this state is the quantum state that this is generated on the IBM quantum computer in a generative model called Transformer, managed to generate or to match this distribution. And this can be also used to generate some other interesting observables, like the entanglement entropy. So based on just observations of experimental or synthetic data in this research, you can infer what's the entanglement entropy of different many-body systems. So this was pretty much, like, what I wanted to show you here. Now let's go to the topic of today. So I'm gonna show you a bit how the different flavors of generative models and how we can construct them. Okay, can I have the screen up, please? Yeah. Thank you. As an outline, so we're going to talk about three different types of generative models. So there are exact likelihood models. There are also approximate likelihood models. You're going to see why we're calling them this way. And at the end, there are implicit likelihood models. Okay, so this classification was actually something that was proposed by Jan Goodfellow in a NeurIPS conference. It's a famous Machine Learning Conference 2016. So you can look it up if you're interested to hear more details. Okay, so it basically inspired from this classification for this lecture. So let's get started with the first part on exact likelihood models. As you can guess from the name, these are models where the likelihood or the negative log likelihood can be efficiently compute it. Okay, so I mean that the p lambda or the sum of those log p lambdas can be computed exactly. And there are different types of these such generative models. So the first one are called autoregressive models. Let me do another counter. Autoregressive models. The reason why they're called autoregressive is because they base their sampling on previous observations. So they have this feature that a prediction of a new variable is based on previous variables. And this can be done through the probability chain rule that you all know. So let's say that our generative model distribution is given this way. So we can decompose it as the product of conditional probabilities. So we have the product of x1. So if x is given as x1, x2, until xn, then we'll have p of x1, p of x2, given x1, until p of xn, given xn minus 1, until x1. So we can do this decomposition. And this step allows to do this feature, so to implement this step over here, where given x1, we can get x2. And given x1 and x2, we can get x3. And given all the variables that were before, we can get x of n. So let me summarize that here. So sampling x, the vector x, is equivalent to sampling x1 and then x2 until xn. So it's a sequential way of sampling our vector. So you can imagine that as if you have a picture, you can do this pixel by pixel. And you have a spin configuration, you can do this spin by spin until you get your full picture. And the way we do this at the model level is by taking our autoregressive model. I'm just going to draw a black box, since we won't have time to go into the detail, but I'm just going to explain the flavor, how this works. So initially, this generative model will output one conditional probability of getting some spin I, given all the previous ones. And what we're going to do is we're going to sample this conditional probability to get x of I. And then we're going to feed that back to the model. We're going to do this many times. So you generate the conditional probability, you sample, you feed to the model, and then you do this step until you construct all of these, and you do the product of them, and then you get this the joint distribution over here. So there are a lot of examples on the literature of such models. So a famous one is the recurrent neural network. Or known as RNNs. There are also transformers. And some old variants that you might be interested in as well are called the MAID and the nate. So this is masked ultra-aggressive density estimator. This is neural ultra-aggressive density estimator. So those are some variants of these ultra-aggressive models. I won't go into details about how they work at the internal level, but I'm just giving examples in case you want to do some research afterwards. Okay, so now something to note about the size of this conditional probability is the following. So this conditional probability has some size, and it depends on each problem we're interested in. So for instance, if we're dealing with words, if these, for instance, X is a sentence and those are separate words, then this has to be the size of the dictionary. So if we're dealing with words, then that size has to be maybe 10K to 1 million, something like that. It's an estimation. For pixels, let's say we want to do pixels with colors. So we're going to need to do, if we use maybe the RGB format, then the size has to be 256 times 3. And then if we have, let's say, we would want to use these to study physical systems, for spins, for instance, then we're going to only have up or down. So that's only two possibilities. So it's even simpler for such physical systems. Another property we require about this conditional probability is to be normalized. So the internal structure of the autoregressive model has to be in such a way that the sum of the elements in this vector has to sum up to 1. And can anyone tell me why that's interesting? What would the fact that this is normalized would say about the joint distribution? Does anyone have an idea?
It's a probability distribution.
So first, it's a probability distribution. And what's special about the probability distribution? So if this is normalized to 1, meaning that the sum of elements here is equal to 1, do you know for special results about what would be the normalization of the joint distribution?
Does that mean that you can?
Yeah. So if all of these are normalized to 1,
then that's normalized?
Yeah, right. That's good. So from that, we can also infer that this is also normalized. So we don't need to compute the normalization, which is, in most cases, intractable. So this is what's good about these models. Just normalizing the conditionals, we can use the mathematical color, the result that this is also normalized. So that's cool. And I should say that these models are mostly useful for discrete data. Now, in the second part of this section, I'm going to show you some other models that are useful for continuous data. But before going into this section, are there any questions regarding ultra-aggressive models? It's just a brief introduction. You don't need to understand what's going on inside here. Just the overall picture. Okay, so let's move on to the normalizing flows. So those models are mostly useful for continuous data. And they're based on a very simple idea, which is the following. So let's say we have some Gaussian distribution, Q of z, which looks something like that. what we do is we do some coordinate transformation on the variable z to get some variable x. And this map has to be bijective or one-to-one. And the result of this transformation would allow us to get some other probability distribution p of x, which is more complicated than this simple one. So we could get something that's very, very complicated, like this landscape over here. Okay? So just from sampling, just from some easy distribution, which is easy to sample, like the Gaussian distribution, and using this transformation, we can get these complicated models that we can use to match the training, the data distribution. And this map over here is actually something that contains parameters that we learn, that we optimize during the gradient descent. So one way to get the expression of p of x and as a function of q of z is to consider the following observation. So we know that this probability density is normalized to 1, right? And since this map is bijective, so we can do a change of variable. So can anyone try to guess what would be the change of variable from z to x in this case? So we have x of z, x is g of z, so z is g minus 1 of x. Can someone try to rewrite this integral by using a chain of variable? Anyone have a guess? Yeah. So let's try to do it together. So we have q, right? So you can just write q. Now we want to replace z by x, right? So you can just write q of j, g minus 1 of x, right? Now we have d of z. Now we can just do replace d of z with, so we want d of x. Now to cancel d of x, we need to divide by d of x. And we have d of z over here, okay? But of course, we need to have an absolute value for the bounds, okay? So from this simple transformation, we got the expression of p of x, which is over here, okay? Now, let's say we do this for something more complicated, maybe for a vector instead of only numbers. Can anyone guess what will be the expression of p of x as a vector? Maybe those who have taken gravity lecture would maybe guess, since like they deal with a lot of these integrals. Yeah. Maybe something technical, but it's kind of similar to this one for the first part. So it's q of j minus 1 of x. And then here, instead of this form over here, we will use like the Jacobian. So we will have the derivative of z with respect to x. And now, to get a number out of that, we're going to use the determinant. So the determinant of the Jacobian, and we take the absolute value. Okay. So of course, to derive that, that's something for related to like mathematical analysis, but just giving you the result over here. So what this says is that we have some Gaussian distribution, and we have something that's multiplied to this Gaussian distribution that has some parameters inside, right? So what we're going to do is, based on the Q and based on this determinant, we're going to get this complicated distribution. And the requirement here is that we need to have a determinant that's easy to compute. So you know, like the determinant of a matrix, something that scales how much, like cubic, right, of the matrix size. But we want something that's cheaper than that. And one way to do this is by choosing a Jacobian matrix in such a way that the matrix is either upper triangular or the opposite of that. Okay? So if we choose a matrix like that, do you see why it's easier to compute the determinant? Okay. So you just take the product of the diagonals, and then you can use this expression. So it's only a linear cost with the size of the linear size of the matrix. So it's much more easier to get the probability of P of X. Okay, yeah.
Do you will always be able to find like a lower triangular or upper triangular?
Very good point, yeah. So what the transformations we use are in such a way that we try to respect this format. So let me give you an example so that it's clearer this way. Maybe it's not visible for you over here. Yeah, let's try an example maybe over here. Okay. So let's take the example of two variables. So let's take this simple transformation where x1 is just z1, but now x2 is z2 times the exponential of, let's say, some variable that some function that depends on z1 plus some additive function that depends on z1, okay? Now, as you can see from that formula, we need to figure out the inverse function. We need to figure out, so this is the map in g. Now we need to figure out g minus 1. So in this case, z1 is very easy, it's just x1. But now, z2, can someone try to guess what would be the expression of z2? Based on, just from here, yeah. Based on x1 and x2. Yeah.
Is it just x2 divided by the quantity?
Right. So we have x2. Of course, we also need to subtract that guy, right? So it's minus t. Z1 is x1, so t of x1. And then that's multiplied by or divided by the exponential or multiplied by exponential of minus s of x1. Okay? So from now we can compute now the Jacobian, right? So now the Jacobian dz over dx. So that's dz1 over dx1, dz1 over dx2, now dz2 over dx1, now dz2 over dx2. Okay? So now if we evaluate, especially this term over here, can you say something about this term, dz1 over dx2?
Zero.
It's zero, right? So just from that, it's upper triangular. So we can stop from here, but you can also derive the expression of the diagonals as well pretty easily. So dz1 with respect to dx1, that's just 1. And dz2 with respect to dx2, that's this exponential factor. And the cool thing here is that we don't need to worry about that term over here. So that's okay because we're gonna take the determinant, okay? And you can see here that, well, this S here can contain parameters. So this function is parameterized. So through gradient descent, we can learn this function. And the other cool thing about these kind of mappings is that we can reiterate them. So for instance, we could have different mappings, G1, G2, until G of M. And each one of them will give a Jacobian, right? You know, the Jacobian of the composition is the product of Jacobians, right? And the determinant of different matrices is the product of the determinant. So you can see from this that you can get a lot of expressivity by doing a lot of composition. Is everything clear?
Yeah.
You see, do you see like how this works in at least at the basic level?
What's the goal at the end? Why we do this transformation?
Yeah, so we do these transformations so that we can have these complicated like distributions so that we can use them to match the distribution of some data set that we're interested in. So of course we will get something complicated, but we're gonna tune the parameters in such a way that we learn this distribution. Hopefully we get something closer. Not perfect, but something like that. Okay? It's clear? Is it clear so far? Okay. So now we can move on to...
It is, I guess, because sampling from a Gaussian is easier and then...
Right, yeah. So getting the expression of this is easier. It's exponential of the quadratic factor. So it's easy to get. And the determinant is something we know how to get, so we can get also the expression of this. Yeah.
Is constructing this function g of z, is that easy in general, or?
So that's something that we have control over, so something we can do. So it's not just something that's given to us, it's something that we can do. So you can, as you saw here, something we can maybe design based on our interest. So we can increase the expressivity by doing these lot of compositions. If it was given to us, of course, that would be hard to do the Jacobian, but since we are actually doing the opposite, so we're designing these kind of functions. Right? So far, so good? Okay. So now let's move on to another section related to another class of generative models called approximate likelihood models. So the first class is called energy-based models. So we're going to see in a second why they're called approximate likelihood. So those are like models that were inspired in the 80s by physicists. So there was a condensed matter physicist called Hopfield who invented the Hopfield network. So it's interesting to see that physics kind of inspired machine learning. It's went back. So Hopfield network has the kind of a similar expression to a Boltzmann distribution, where we have the exponential of some energy function that depends on some parameters lambda, and we have the partition function where you sum in over all these Boltzmann factors, and the expression of this energy can be something like the sum over ij, wij, xi, xj, plus some bias term, bi, xi. Okay, so it's similar to a spin system, right? Like where these parameters here are learnable, right? Now something to note over here is that if you attempt to compute the partition function, which is the sum over all possible configurations, of the exponential factor, you'll see that you get something that's intractable in general. If you have a generic function, right? In some cases, we can do it for special forms of these parameters, but in general, it's not possible to compute this sum efficiently. So this is why we call these approximate likelihood models, because we cannot get the expression of p of x, right? But something cool we can do is, instead, we can do the ratios, right? And what does that inspire you doing something if we can compute the ratios? Does anyone have an idea?
Ratio of what?
Yeah.
Ratio of what? I didn't.
The ratio of some two probabilities for two different data points. So let's say we have px2 over px1, where x2 is different than x1. So this we can do efficiently. So that's just exponential of minus e lambda x2 minus e lambda of x1, right? So if we can do this efficiently, can we do something with that? Have you learned about Monte Carlo methods before? Sampling methods? Does Metropolis sampling say something to you? Right. So from this, we can do Metropolis sampling. So for instance, let's say we start from some random configuration and we do some spin flip. We can compute the ratio of the new configuration of the probabilities of the new configuration over the probability of the old configuration. And we can get this expression to do the Metropolis moves. So based on that, we can still use Metropolis sampling to get some new configurations, right? And so what I also wanted to say about energy-based models is that there are a lot of variants. So this is just a special form of energy-based models. There are also other models called restricted Boltzmann machines, but I won't go into that into this lecture. I just wanted to highlight this idea that, well, this partition function is what makes these models approximate instead of exact. Now I'll move on to another model, or other class of models called autoencoders. Where you have the following construction. So let's say we have some data point. But so before going to this section, are there any questions about energy-based models? Is the idea clear? Cool. So now for autoencoders, we have the following construction. So we have an encoder, which you can think of as a neural network. Its outputs a variable z that we call a latent variable. It's an internal variable. And using this latent variable, we can use a decoder, which can be also another neural network, which allows us to get a reconstruction of x. Okay? So the idea is very simple. So we try to squeeze the data point into a smaller variable, which we call the latent variable. So we're trying to keep the relevant features of the data point, and we're using these relevant features to reconstruct the same data point or an approximation of the maybe the picture we already fed into the model. Okay, so from this point over here, we can see that in order to have this close to this one, we need to have a cost function that has this form. So the cost function we can design to optimize these kind of models could have something of this form, where we minimize the distance between the generated picture and the original picture, for instance, if we're dealing with pictures. Okay? And just from this form, you can see also why these are called approximate likelihood models. So for instance, if we take the analogy of the cost as the negative log likelihood, so this is so the likelihood will be, in this case, the exponential of minus the cost, and which will be the exponential of the distance between the data points. And you can see that this form is kind of similar to that one, where we need to have to divide by the partition function. Okay, so this form is actually like just an approximate form of the likelihood, okay, since we don't have the partition function. So what's cool about these models is that once you train them to fit the original data points, you can actually remove the encoder, and you can just feed some noise into our decoder to get some new data points. Okay? So this is the trick. So you first train your model, and then after you train, you just throw the decoder, and you generate some new data points out of that. Okay? And I should say, like, so this is like the traditional form of autoencoders. Some other advanced variants are called variational autoencoders. So I won't talk about that in this lecture, just in case you want to dive deeper after the lecture. There are also some other models that have some kind of same functionalities as autoencoders. Those are called diffusion models, in case you have heard of them. So it's something that's a bit more complicated, but they kind of have similar working principles using some latent variables. So now, after...
The P of X, it's like similar case.
Sorry, can you say that again?
Yeah. I here call Z as P of X. It's similar to previous cases. So from X, I go to P of X, and then I generate new data out of...
Right, yeah. So the thing is that here we don't know what's P of X, but it's kind of like an approximate way. And the way this model works is that we don't need the P of X in order to generate data points. So this is what's interesting about this model.
What is that Z exactly?
So Z is just a vector. You can think of it as a vector that has size, in principle, smaller than this one, where you're compressing this picture into a smaller vector. So this model like does not require an exact knowledge of P of lambda as compared to the normalized inflows and ultra-aggressive models.
What is that box, the decoding
box? Yeah, so decoder, you can think of it maybe as a neural network, a feed-forward neural network with multiple layers, with different connections, where you're taking Z and you're outputting X hats, okay? You could also have different sorts of neural networks, convolutional neural networks, depends on the task. Okay. Same thing for the decoder as well. So far, so good? Okay. So in the last few minutes we have, we're going to now talk about implicit likelihood models. Point three, implicit models. So in these models, the knowledge of the likelihood is actually implicit. And the idea here is that these models are just used for sampling. So they're just used for sampling new configurations. And to understand this idea of implicit, we can take the example of generative adversarial networks, or also known as GANs, generative adversarial networks, GANs, where the setup is very simple. So we have two kind of modules. So we have a module called a discriminator. We call D, and we have somewhere over here another module called D generator. Okay, and what's going on here is that we have some data set that we call X real. So those are the real data points that we have in our trained data set. And what this generator does is that it tries to generate some fake data points, right? So what we do is we feed some noise to get some fake data points. And what this discriminator does is that it outputs a label, and if this label is 1, then we're saying that the output we got is real, and if it's fake, it tries to output that this label, that the picture we, or the input we have fed is fake. Okay? So it's kind of a competition between these two different modules. So you can think of this as a neural network in disguise, a neural network. And what happens is that the goal of the generator is to generate fake data points that are similar to the real data points, in the sense that they are generated from the same data distribution. But the goal of the discriminator is to undo that. It's trying to distinguish between X fake and X real. And one way we can do this is through the use of this following cost function, which has a similar form to the cross entropy that you have learned. So we have a first term, which has the following expression, which is this guy over here. Let me explain that in a second. So this is the piece related to the real data points. And we have another piece related to the fake data points. Okay. So this is, the first piece is minus log probability of the real data points. And sorry, here it's 1 minus d fake. So this is minus the log probabilities of the fake data points. So to understand this, like, it will be good to do examples. So for instance, to have this const function minimized, what we need to have is this guy equal to 1 and this guy equal to 0, right? Because if this is 0 and this is 1, then the cost function is 0. And we know this is, in general, positive. So what the discriminator needs to do is to minimize the cost function to get as close as possible to 0 in order to distinguish between the real and the fake data points, right? So here, what we need to do is to minimize over the parameters of the discriminator. But for the generator, what it needs to do is needs to maximize this term especially, so that we're undoing the job of the discriminator. So what we're doing also is we're maximizing at the same time the same cost function. It's like a game between the two. And it turns out that the generator has the winning strategy. So of course, I don't have proof for that, but I'm going to give you an intuitive picture of how this works. And this will be the end of this lecture. So intuitive picture. So initially, let's say we imagine that our data points are one-dimensional. So let's imagine here that we have our real data points here. And our fake data points somewhere far from the real data points. Okay, so from here we can see that it's easy for the discriminator to distinguish between the two. So it can assign some probabilities to all the models for being real. So of course, the fake has to get very low probabilities and the real ones some very high probabilities. Okay. Now what's going to happen is that after some training epoch, the generator will make these points closer because it's trying to undo the job of the discriminator. So the real data points will be as they are. And but the fake data points will get closer to the data points, to the real data points. And then you can imagine that after maybe many iterations, the fake data points will be closer to the real data points. So in this case, it's very hard for the discriminator to assign this clear distinction between real data points and fake data points. Okay, in this case, the generator wins. And what happens after is that we can throw the discriminator part and just use the generator to generate some new data points. So we can just feed some noise, and from that we can get some new data points that look very similar to the training data. Okay? So just from this picture we can see that, well, we didn't need really a knowledge of the probability, like the underlying probabilities of this model. We just, out of this game between the generator and the discriminator, we can have samples that look like the training data points. Okay? So this is pretty much all I wanted to tell you today. Of course, if you're interested to learn more about generative modeling, there is a mini school organized by Lauren in May, where we're going to talk about Restricted Boltzmann machines and recurrent neural networks. So if you're interested, you can learn more in this school. And yeah, thank you all for your attention. I look forward to see you in the afternoon. Thank you.
Everyone, let's thank Mohammed for a great lecture. And we have a teacher.
Thank
you.
Thanks very much. Thank you.